Our fourth case this morning is 19-3237 Clark v. City of Williamsburg, and for the appellant, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. I am Alan Johnson, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Eric Clark, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you for taking the case, Mr. Johnson. We appreciate coming in on it.
It's my pleasure. This case arises out of a notice of violation of the city's sign ordinance that the city's enforcement officer sent to Mr. Clark. Mr. Clark asserts two claims in this case and in this appeal, both under 42 U.S.C. 1983. His first claim is violation of his First Amendment rights. His second claim is violation of his Fourth Amendment rights. And in my arguments today, I want to focus just or primarily on the Fourth Amendment claim. Now, the Fourth Amendment claim arises out of a visit by the city's enforcement officer, Mr. De La Torre, to Mr. Clark's home to talk about the notice of violation. The district court granted summary judgment in favor of the city on the Fourth Amendment claim, holding that Mr. De La Torre did not conduct a search of Mr. Clark's home or the curtilage, but rather he engaged in a proper knock and talk, which is a consensual encounter, not a search. In reaching this conclusion, the district court primarily relied upon this court's decision in United States versus Shuck. And Mr. Clark, in this appeal, contends that the Shuck decision is distinguishable from the facts of this case, and that a tribal issue of fact exists as to whether or not Mr. De La Torre engaged in a proper knock and talk. And I want to highlight...
Was this a knock and talk?
No.
No. It's not a search. Not a search either, is it?
It was not a search. It was a search. Our contention is that it was not a proper knock and talk, and therefore it was a search of his home or his curtilage.
But for a while, I thought we were done.
No, I misspoke. I apologize, Judge.
Well, I thought you misspoke, but
yes.
Not only must it be a search, but it must be an unreasonable search.
Unreasonable search.
How could this possibly be an unreasonable search? All he did was go around the corner of the house, looking for the homeowner.
Well, because he was not a proper knock and talk, because he did not go to the front porch, which was the normal route to access the property of any visitor. He bypassed the front porch.
But was it reasonable for him to do that when we see what the front area of the house looks like? It looks almost as though it's difficult, if not impossible, to get even to the front door, much less through it.
Well, it's Mr. Clark's contention and my contention that raises a fact question. It's for the jury to determine whether or not his perception was reasonable, and that the facts can give rise to two different views of them. And although the porch, as even Mr. Clark admitted, was not inviting, it was his testimony that was the normal route of access to his premises by visitors.
What do you think a reasonable trick-or-treater would have done in approaching that porch?
They would have, well, if it was a brave trick-or-treater, they would have gone to the front door, because Mr. Clark testified that although there's a chair and a mattress on the front porch, that it was accessible, that there was about 5 to 6 feet between the chair and the front door, and that a reasonable trick-or-treater would go to that rather than to the back door, because the back door could not be seen from any part of the driveway or any publicly accessible property. And there's no evidence that the officer, Mr. De La Torre, even knew that there was a back door. As you approach...
You know, we're looking at whether there was an implied license here, you know, under Jardines and the Tenth Circuit cases, and if that's the appropriate legal framework, and I think it is there a reason under that doctrine that the implied license could not be enlarged to include multiple entrances to a home? In other words, a front door, a side door, and maybe even in some circumstances, a back door. Couldn't we have a more expansive implied license than you think applies? And if not, what's the distinction? What's the limiting principle for your position?
Well, I don't think a front door, nor did Mr. Clark argue that a front door is the only way that you can access to a home. But the question is, what is the normal route of access for anyone visiting the premises? That's the standard that this court adopted in Shuck, and I think is the proper standard. So the question is, were there other alternatives here that would have been a normal route of access to the house?
Well, what if I heard a lawnmower or some sound from the backyard and knew that the person I was trying to encounter was not inside the house, but was out back. So I go out back and, you know, try to raise his attention. Why does that become an unreasonable search?
Because again, I think, and that was what the officer said here, explained, he said, well, I thought I heard a noise back there, but that is not relative to the question is, was he taking a normal route of access for anyone visiting the premises? And a trick-or-treater, for example, wouldn't go to the back door rather than to the front door of Mr. Clark's if he heard somebody back there. Trick-or-treater or a Girl Scout would have gone to the front door. They didn't know what's in the back door. The back door or the back part could not be seen even from the driveway. So
how does the path leading anywhere, the path evidence in this case, what do we do with that? Does that indicate where the front door is?
Well, the path, there's no worn path, but the path or the route of access would be from the driveway up onto the porch. Now, it was not worn, but the grass was cut. It wasn't gated like the Shuck case. The Shuck case, there was a fence around the front part, and it was locked, and the officers testified that they believed it was locked and that it had not been disused. Here, the officer simply testified that he didn't think the front porch had been used, but he didn't clarify why. He never explained why he couldn't cross the grass to go up onto the porch. He never testified.
Isn't our approach here, again, to harken back to reasonableness? Seeing what he saw, was it reasonable for him to go to the back door?
Yes, I agree. And it's our contention that that reasonable issue under these facts presents a genuine issue of material fact, which should be decided by the jury and not on summary judgment. And the reasonableness, you have to take into a wide variety of factors, but it is an objective standard, not a subjective standard. And part of that would be what it looked like. And I think what was presented to the court was not only the testimony, but the pictures of the front door, which are on pages 27, 28 of the brief, which in many ways, a picture's worth 1,000 words. And if you look at that, it's our contention a reasonable jury could conclude that the normal route of access for anyone visiting those premises would have been up on the front porch, and the officer did not do that.
I thought that your client in this case said that he had trained relatives to go to the back door. A nephew or some reference like that was made in his testimony?
Correct. And again, that factor would be considered by the jury, but the officer, Mr. Della Torre, he wasn't aware of that fact. I think what the jury would have to look at are what facts were known and observable by the officer, and was it reasonable for him to assume that the normal route of access to the premises was not on the front through the front porch? Because what's key here is he never made an effort to go to the front porch and knock on the door, or to even try and see if he could knock on the door.
Was there a fence or a no trespass sign?
No, not in this case. So unless the court has any other questions, I would like to reserve what I have left for possible rebuttal.
Let's hear from the city's attorney, Mr. Pig.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Steve Pig. I represent the city of Williamsburg, the appellee defendant. I'm a little thrown off because I actually didn't intend to talk about the Fourth Amendment claim at all and focus on the First Amendment claim, but I will address it very briefly. I think the photographs that are included in our brief are consistent and show that the court's decision that no reasonable jury could find that it was unreasonable to follow the driveway to the back and attempt to find Mr. Clark after hearing him back there is the correct decision.
Now, Officer Dellatore, however, did not say that he heard Mr. Clark. He said he heard somebody.
Correct.
Right.
But he also knew that Mr. Clark was single and the only person that lived at that residence. So, I mean, it was.
Is that one of your arguments in the summary judgment briefs?
That was not argued in the appeal.
Okay.
The evidence was that he stayed on the driveway. He got to the back. There was an enclosure around the back door so that you couldn't see the back door from where he was, and he never breached that. He never got past the apron, a gravel apron that was there at the back of the house.
Now, why is there an implied license to go to the back door, even if the front door is inaccessible? You know, if you walk up the driveway, he gets past these barrels. He's got all of these obstructions. He walks around these things, goes parallel to the backyard, albeit on this driveway or parking area, parallel to the backyard. Why is there under Jardines, which was dealing with a motion to suppress, not a civil case, why is there an implied license to go parallel to the backyard, even if it was reasonable? Because you haven't argued that it wasn't a search. You haven't argued on appeal, and the district judge didn't address whether it was reasonable conduct. The only issue that you've raised is under Jardines, was there an implied license to go parallel to the backyard? Why is there an implied license to do that?
I don't think I'm understanding the use of the term parallel to the backyard.
He was basically a couple of feet away from getting into the guy's backyard.
That would be accurate.
If somebody walks up my driveway to my backyard, now I have a fence. If I didn't have a fence, I would say, what in the world are you doing? What makes you think you can come into, you know, right next to my backyard?
Without a fence and without a trespassing sign, I don't think that people do consider walking to the back of the driveway to look for a person when they've heard something back there to be unreasonable.
But under Jardines, is the issue whether or not the conduct was reasonable, or was it simply whether or not there was an implied license to do that?
I think it's both. I think you look at whether an objectively reasonable officer under those circumstances, knowing what the officer had, would believe that there's an implied license. Go back and check.
What if Officer Dellatore hadn't hurt anybody? Would there still have been an implied license to go to the back?
Under these circumstances, with this residence, with the front door being clearly blocked and disused, and even though it may have been possible to get to it, it obviously was not used. There was not only items that he had placed on the front porch that blocked the entrance, so you would have to squeeze by between a pillar and the chair.
So you're right that there's not an implied license to go to the front yard. Under Jardines, is there always an implied license to go to somebody's door, some door? Now, he's arguing that maybe I just didn't want any visitors at all. I'm an unfriendly guy.
And without the posting of a no trespass sign, I think there is still an implied license.
What if there was a sign that said no visitors? Would there still have been an implied license to go to the backyard?
Probably not. That would probably take the reasonableness of that approach out, the reasonableness of believing that there's an implied license away from the officer's assessment. But under these circumstances, there was no such situation. It's true we didn't specifically address where there was a search, but a knock and talk such as this, if it would classify as a knock and talk, is not a search. He was simply attempting to talk with Mr. Clark about the issue on his right of way. If the court has any more questions about the Fourth Amendment claim, I'm happy to try to answer those. Let me briefly discuss the First Amendment claim then. Our position is that Mr. Clark received his day in court. The trial court found that that he did have standing to make a claim based upon the notice of violation that he had received from the code enforcement officer, but that he had no standing to assert a claim based upon any other provisions of the sign code. The notice of violation was very specific. It is even titled Ray, City of Williamsburg, Right of Way, and then Mr. Clark's address. All the references in the notice are to the right of way, not to any other portion of the property. Specifically tells him that he had inspected the city's right of way. There were large barrels, signs, and other objects affixed to the right of way, and he needed to remove those, and that political signs are prohibited on the right of way or other public property.
Does the notice cite to any provision in the regs?
It does not. The district court concluded that it applied to a certain section, an exemption for political signs, because some of the language came right out of that exemption. Mm-hmm. But the notice itself addresses the prohibition of having signs or other objects on the right of way. And at trial, that's what was tried. What damages have you sustained as a result of this notice of violation? Mr. Clark simply did not ever have standing to assert a claim based on any other aspects of the ordinance. His argument on
isn't he right though that once the court severed out the political sign portion of the ordinance, there was no protection for political signs under any other provision of the code. And isn't that a problem?
I would like to evade that question because that's not really the issue here. But I think that's a fair reading of the code. And in fact, the city has passed a motion shortly after the court's decision, a moratorium on enforcement of the code, which continues in effect.
On any portion of the code?
Any portion of the sign code. The sign code is one portion of the zoning code, and it's only the sign code that they passed a moratorium on. You have to remember, this is a city of 389 people by the 2018 census. So, they're not flush with funds to go into an analysis of their signing code, and they've just left it hanging there, and they're not enforcing it at all. In fact,
there's the moratorium on enforcement of any of these signage regulations. On all of them. And there's also no municipal court judge.
No municipal court judge.
So and Williamsburg is wide open. Is that it?
Yes, they can post anything they want. And there's no code enforcement officer. In fact, as of July 2015, shortly after the notice of violation, because of funding, the code enforcement officer was gone. So the officer who initiated the notice of violation is no longer there, nor is there any other code enforcement officer.
So what do we do with this? Is this moot then?
I think it still addresses standing. We didn't really raise it as a mootness argument, although we get very close to that. there's no credible threat of enforcement, so there's never any standing to challenge anything other than this one notice of violation that he's had a trial on.
Or put another way, what relief could we grant for the plaintiff if there's no possibility, at least we think so now, no possibility of enforcement?
I don't think there is any relief. Effectively, the issue is mooted by the city's actions and the court's decision that invalidated part of the ordinance.
Now, Mr. Johnson argues that even though that it could also, if there was a code enforcement officer appointed, and he points to somebody that would do it for free, he says that they could prosecute in, I think it's Franklin County or the Franklin Municipal Court. Is that correct or incorrect?
Well, first, that's not on the record on appeal. That's just something that Mr. Clark, not Mr. Johnson, Mr. Clark, pro se, put into his brief.
Clark. Yeah, that was Mr. Clark, right.
And I'm frankly not sure whether a city ordinance could be prosecuted in the state district court. The city's made no effort to do that. And when you look at the standing requirements, the mere fact that there's a statute out there with no indication that's going to be enforced against the plaintiff leaves the plaintiff without standing.
Can I go back to Chief Judge Tippett's question about the other provisions? And I understand you don't want to answer that, but if you're basically your interpretation, just like Mr. Clark's, that if you take out the exemption provision in 4A, and then I think it's in Section 5, that remains in place, that would, if the answer to Judge Timkovich's question is that you now can't have any political signs, even if you delete the problematic provision in 4A, well, he's got these political signs. Now, why wouldn't there be a credible threat of enforcement based on the continuing provision that nobody can have any political signs?
Well, first, there's a state statute which preempts the city's ordinance that allows for political signs for a period of, I think, 45 days before and 3 days after an election. So that would control, and there would be that provision. The ordinance itself, the way it's written, it defines certain signs, and it does not define political signs at all. So you could argue, and Mr. Clark argues, that therefore there's no way I can have a political sign because it's not covered. That's not an unreasonable interpretation, and the city's not trying to enforce it. You might note in the photograph on page 27 of the appellee's brief, I think it's 27, the picture shows that Mr. Clark, in fact, had what I would call a political sign. You can see an Obama sign that's a very large sign painted to the right, or would be the left side as you're coming out of his house, And the notice of enforcement said nothing about that sign. There's never been any indication to Mr. Clark that the city would prohibit him from having political signs at any other place on his property. Their sole concern was the danger and obstructions that were on the city's right of way. Did I answer your question?
Sure did. Yeah, thank you.
I see I'm about out of time. I'm certainly happy to try to answer any other questions.
There's an issue by the plaintiff about the district court improperly narrowing or framing its First Amendment issue for trial.
And I understood that argument to be not allowing him to challenge the entire city code. So I think it's still a standing issue. He also makes the argument that the court's decision that invalidated one section of the code and then created problems for the other sections of the code, that he should have been able to try that. But I don't think that creates standing when there's still never been any attempt to enforce that part of the code against him. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Appreciate that. There's some rebuttal time for Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do want to address the standing issue, the First Amendment issue, since you have discussed it. As I understand it, Mr. Clark's contention is that the signs, according to the district court, were the political signs that he had in the right of way. And by political signs, I mean election signs. He had signs that were supporting certain people for elections, which are covered by the state law. But his contention is that he had other political signs, or signs he considered to be political, in the right of way that were not covered or were not included in the election signs. One of those signs said, "Protect our troops." And the other symbol was a symbol of a cross. And his argument is that he was not able to base his arguments on being prevented from displaying those signs or political signs, which were not election signs. And on the question of threat of enforcement, it's still his position that although there may be no code enforcement officer and there may be no municipal court, he still doesn't know what the future will hold, and that he, because of this ordinance, he believes that his First Amendment rights have been chilled. And although in the first trial, what was litigated was the chilling of his First Amendment rights in presenting the election signs, he was not able to argue how he felt that his First Amendment rights were chilled in regard to the other signs that he had, which is protect our troops and a cross. So that is his contention on why he believes he has standing and why the district court improperly limited what his First Amendment claim was. And unless the court has any other questions for me, I don't have any further argument.
Counsel, we appreciate you ceding the rest of your time. You are excused, and the case shall be submitted. Thank you very much.